ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free.
The Herald of Truth broadcast is on the air, a program of spirit and truth dedicated to teaching the way of God more perfectly. These broadcasts contain keys to help unlock knowledge and reveal hidden truths of the Bible in these last days. Christians, called to a higher level of understanding, will be given Bible-based solutions to their personal as well as national problems. They will want to find out more about their part in God's plan. Our mailing address is Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, and will be given again at the end of this broadcast.
Good evening. This is Brother Mike welcoming you to another one of our first of the month Kingdom Concepts programs. We're being heard tonight over two transmitters at WWCR, transmitter 3 and 4, that's 4.840 megahertz and 5.890 megahertz, and also on radio station WBCQ, 7.490 megahertz. If you would like to join the conversation tonight, you can call our toll-free number, 877-924-7722. That's 877-924-7722. 877-YAWS-RACE will help you remember that. For our foreign listeners, and if the domestic listeners would also like to call direct, you can call 678-949-5091. That's 678-949-5091. Last month, we had a guest who was a lecturer, author, an expert in biblical money, Bruce G. McCarthy. We didn't finish our subject last month, so I've invited him back this month. We're happy to have you back, Bruce. Welcome to the broadcast.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike. Glad to be back.
Well, this is the Independence Day weekend, and I thought maybe you'd like to comment a little bit about the part that money played in the American Revolution and the difference between the Continentals under the Articles of Confederation versus the coined money under the Constitution.
Well, under the Articles of Confederation, which very seldom do we talk about, I guess, these days, the Continental Congress had been given the authority to coin money and emit bills, those bills being bills of credit, what today people call popularly paper money. When the Constitution was written up and debated at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia back in 1787, they struck from the Articles of Confederation and the Constitutional draft those three words, and emit bills. So consequently, when one reads the Constitution, at Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 5, where Congress has the power to coin money, the words and emit bills do not appear. And since the Constitution is a document of express or delegated powers, if the power isn't expressed, it doesn't exist, which seems to somehow be lost on an awful lot of people who insist that Congress has the power to emit bills of credit in the form of United States notes. But this changeover from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution expresses an economic changeover, which is quite important. It was carried over into the Coinage Act of April 2nd, 1792, which actually put our monetary provisions into practice. It fleshed them out. And what I'd like to point out to the listener right off the bat is that it's section 19 of an act that only had 20 sections in it. The government was forbidden, or any public official was forbidden, to debase any of the coins that were going to be emitted, and those coins were going to be gold and silver, because the Constitution only provided for gold and silver coins. And that section 19 said, be it enacted that if any of the gold and silver coins shall be debased or made worse, every such officer, that would be an officer of the treasury, or person who shall commit said offenses, shall be deemed guilty of felony and shall suffer death. It was a death penalty offense for debasing our coinage. That's how seriously our founding fathers took the subject of substantive money, gold and silver. And while that may be a point for historians to point out to show that they know something about maybe monetary history, and it's something for lawyers to point out that, by golly, we were going to use gold and silver, weren't we? What's really important to the average person and to all of our listeners is why they insisted on that. And it was because government was not going to be given the power to steal from its own citizens, which it would do or be able to do with any type of credit instrument. Because the purpose of a credit instrument is to obtain what you, the producer, produce now and pay you later. And if government could get away with it, they would get from you what you produce now and pay you never. And that's the purpose of legal tender.
I guess they just went through the problem with the Continentals as worthless as a Continental.
Yes, George Washington pointed that out. He said that a wagon load of currency will scarcely purchase a wagon load of provisions. The Continental Congress issued copious quantities of promissory notes. That's what they were. And they became worthless. I think it was John Adams who said that they became as plenteous as oak leaves. But all of those bills, the Continental Notes, would state that that bill entitled the bearer, or the person who carried it, excuse me, to receive so many Spanish milled dollars, or the value thereof in gold or silver. And a Spanish mill dollar was a peso de real. That was a silver coin, which was later copied by the U.S. Mint and made into a $1 weight of silver, most people erroneously calling it a silver dollar. But they were promises to pay money. But what the Continental Congress did not do, which was to their credit, is they did not make them legal tender. So you were not forced to take a Continental note. There is a difference between a bill of credit without legal tender and a bill of credit with legal tender that's been impressed upon it. And legal tender was used to be called by our ancestors forcing acts. You were forced. They knew you were forced to take it. And there were penalties in various states, for example, if you didn't take the legal tender of the states, because free people were being compelled to take it. It'd be kind of nice if you and I could counterfeit bills, you know, if we could print or write checks that were back, you know, or promises to, how do I say it, you know, have a checking account against no funds and then have a law that compelled people to take your bad checks. And that's exactly what so-called paper money is. And it's theft. And the Bible says, thou shalt not steal.
I guess the Weimar Republic and us today under the Federal Reserve are going through the same thing.
You're talking about Germany in the 1920s?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they went through a very serious period of inflation. They were one of a half dozen advanced countries back in the 1920s that went through horrendous inflation. Germany became the model of efficiency. They cranked out those bogus notes so fast that wages, had to be increased on a weekly basis. And people were paid in those things every day. And, it got so bad that a person would be paid at noon and would, run out to the fence and hand, a stack of his notes to his wife or some family member and tell him to go out and get something, anything. And Professor Edwin Kemmerer, in his book that he wrote back, I think it was around 1930 or 35, called Money, very simple title. He said that there were ludicrous scenes in Germany back in those days of bachelors, for example, buying cases of diapers, or people buying toothbrushes by the case. They would acquire anything they could to get rid of that so-called paper money. And it got so bad that a 1,000, in fact, I have one in my collection. It's a 1,000 Deutschmark note. And they hadn't gone into circulation yet. They were still sitting in bank vaults. And it was a crisp bill. And so they took them back and reprinted them. And they stamped diagonally across these notes, Ein Milliard Marks. Well, a million N is a million, but a milliard is a billion. And immediately this 1,000 Deutschmark note became a billion marks simply by printing another number on top of it. And the largest denomination for circulating banknotes in Germany finally hit 100 trillion. There was a lot of zeros. Yeah,
that's right.
Okay. Countries like Argentina.
I guess we're doing the same thing today with the Federal Reserve note. I know that I'm a fan of old-time radio. I a lot of times listen to the programs from the 40s and 50s. And just in regular conversation during the program, they're mentioning the price of, well, a taxi or food or various other items. And there's been such a large amount of inflation since that time.
Yeah, hamburger, and there was a restaurant I remember stopping at in Maine a few years ago, and they had a placemat for everybody, and on the placemat they told you that I think it was Moody's Diner, in fact, and they had prices for Moody's Diner from the 1930s, and the hamburger was 10 cents. I think a lobster roll was something like, I think it might have been as much as 20 cents. But that, of course, was back in the days when you paid 10 cents or 20 cents weight of silver, 90% pure silver. And, of course, things are much more reasonably priced when you pay for something in silver than when you pay for it in units of absolutely nothing. And trying to get that conveyed to people is kind of difficult, but dollars and cents today measure absolutely nothing, but a dollar is a unit of weight measurement in the decimal system. And it used to weigh a quantity of gold and a quantity of silver. Now it weighs absolutely nothing. And nothing is what people use as money. They don't even use paper as money. Paper's too heavy to be used as money. But, Argentina, Brazil, Peru, Mexico, Venezuela, back in the 1980s and the 1990s, they endured 3,000 to 5,000% inflation. Prices could double in a week. And they went through what Germany went through. In fact, when Germany went through their inflationary period, it got so bad that they finally called in all of the Deutschmark notes, and they gave you a Rentenmark note in exchange. And the exchange rate was 1 trillion to 1. You turned in a trillion, with a T, tango, 1 trillion Deutschmarks, and you got a new note that said 1 Rentenmark. Now, that's quite a deflationary an exchange rate, 1 trillion to 1. And in France, when they issued their assignats during the Reign of Terror, 1790s or thereabouts, things got so bad with those notes that they turned in 30 assignats and they got a mandat, another piece of paper. So it was a 30-to-1 exchange rate. But Germany just topped them all. I mean, a trillion to one. And we're going to have the same thing happen here eventually. I don't know when it's going to happen. I can't predict the future. But what they're doing in this country, you've noticed, is that they don't give you any larger denomination notes. For example, a $100 bill is as high as it goes. Okay? And now, there used to be $500 bills, $1,000 notes. Even $10,000 notes. But you don't see those kind of notes in circulation. In fact, most of those high denomination notes only circulated between banks. But in this day and age, we actually need notes with much higher denominations on them. But they don't issue them because they're moving everybody into debit cards, because that's where the information is collected on all of the people's transactions. So they have no intention, evidently, of going into high denomination notes, and as inflation continues, people will more automatically, of their own volition, change over to using debit cards, which is what the system wants.
Or even worse, credit cards, which have interest attached to the amount charged.
Well, I've not played with the debit card thing, but it seems to me you can probably incur some sort of a charge or surcharge if you make any mistakes or something with your debit cards. But America is just moving into plastic. And the Fed notes, the day of the Federal Reserve note is soon to be gone. And people could slow that process down. In fact, they could probably prevent it from happening if they just refuse to get debit cards. But people just go out and apply for them because they insist that it's too inconvenient to do business without them. So we do it to ourselves, you know. We make the choices. Just as we made the choice back in the late 40s. Back in the late 1940s, you could still get silver in the 1950s. But people didn't want the silver. They wanted pieces of paper, silver certificates. And so eventually, once that preference was expressed, the Federal Reserve System was able to confiscate the silver after it had already confiscated the gold. But again, it's our choice. Of course, they make it easy for us to choose the wrong thing, but they apply a little pressure here and there. But,
well, those in the know have been predicting the collapse of our monetary system for quite a few years. But one thing that's happening recently, or in the process of happening, is that the U.S. Federal Reserve note is no longer going to be the standard of the world. They're coming up with different standards, perhaps the Chinese note, or perhaps a combination of several countries, or a worldwide currency. How do you think this is going to affect our monetary situation in the near future?
Well, you use the expression, the collapse of our monetary system, and that's exactly what everybody calls it. But the monetary system of the United States collapsed effectively in about 1965, because there were only two things that were declared to be as money in the United States, and that was gold and silver. The statutes, for example, Title 12, United States Code, Section 152, was the only place in all of the federal statutes that actually defined what the term lawful money meant. It said that the terms lawful money or lawful money of the United States shall be construed to mean gold or silver coin of the United States. Well, gold was demonetized officially in 1934. Silver was demonetized between 1963 and 1968. But it was taken out of the coinage in 1965, at least out of the dimes, quarters, and let's see now. The halves were reduced in the next few years, I'm going to say up to about 1968, from 90% silver down to 40% silver. But since 1968, there's been absolutely no silver in any of the coinage. And nothing was monetized to replace them. So our monetary system collapsed approximately 50 years ago. What we're going through now is a collapse of a credit system. And credit and money are not synonymous. Now, you've got the various countries, what they call BRIC, you know, what Brazil, Russia, India, China, and Korea, I guess. You know, they have stated that they're going to stop using so-called dollars. And they're going to boycott the Federal Reserve System, in effect, which is what we started doing. I say people who were in our little trade network that we started back in 1984, the pipeline. That's what we were doing. Within this country, we were boycotting the Federal Reserve System, not using Federal Reserve notes, checks, credit cards. They didn't have debit cards then. But that idea just didn't quite take hold. We couldn't get enough momentum going, or the critical mass, you might say, to make it work conveniently. It was very inconvenient, but I went for 10 years without using Federal Reserve notes. It was awkward. I didn't gain any weight. but it proved that it was possible to to actually survive in this country without having to handle a Federal Reserve note. And I kind of like to see that happen again, but you're going to have to open the eyes of some people, and you're going to have to somehow spurn them to some level of conviction to say that I've had enough of this credit system. But it's going to have to take some understanding as to why one wants to step out of the system, perhaps in response to Revelation 18:4, come out of her, my people, and be not partakers of her sins and of her plagues. And it's talking about an economic system. But too many Christians
last time you were my guest. Last time you were my guest, you get cut off by the phone line somehow. And at that time, you were speaking on self-control and violation of God's laws. And also, you spoke about the solution being by addressing the cause rather than the symptoms. Would you like to touch on that? Because I believe you spoke to dead air for a little bit of a while on that subject.
Well, gosh, I do remember being on the program and sitting here in pure isolation, not realizing it, of course. I think I was up here for something like 6 minutes, and you were trying to figure out what to do with your guest not even connected to the program. You brought up the subject of cause, and I guess I would address that because there is a cause and effect relationship with everything that goes on. I remember doing a program, I won't mention the name of the host or hostess, but I remember going on the air with this particular person, and we were going to talk about money, banking, and credit. We hadn't discussed what we were going to talk about prior to going on the air, and the first question she asked was, what's the solution to the problem? And I thought, man, we're not going to get a chance to discuss this subject for very long because already we're going to solve the problem. I said, well, the solution is to understand the cause. If a person understood what caused his disease, he would be able to reverse the consequences that he's suffering by avoiding the cause. And if a person understands the cause of our economic maladies, he now has the key to the solution. But it'd be like going to a mechanic and asking a mechanic to fix your car and asking the mechanic if he can tell you what's wrong with your car. And he says, no, I have no idea why the engine doesn't run, but I can fix it. Well, how can you possibly fix something if you don't understand the cause of it? But that's the allopathic approach that we take in America to darn near everything. I think the medical profession, at least, has certainly perfected that. We don't know what caused your cancer, but we're going to treat it. Well, no wonder we have such an atrocious, quote-unquote, cure rate for cancer. We don't know the cause. And so I was suggesting to this lady that if we understood what caused our problem, you know, our economic problem, we could cure it. But most people are not interested in what's causing it. And the cause of our economic problem is that we, number one, we don't have anything that we're using as money. Now, of course we have a monetary crisis. If anybody can identify what we're using as money, if it's measured in dollars, I'll give them 100 pounds of it. And I'll give them, I'll send it to them from here. You know, if they want to call in and lay claim to that reward. Dollars aren't money, they're just units of measure. We've got a system of 100% confiscation in favor of government and central banks. They can steal what everybody else produces. Everybody else has to work by the sweat of their brow to earn numbers of absolutely nothing that the first party, called the bank and Uncle Sam, working in tandem, get for nothing. That's 100% confiscation. The Bible doesn't allow for that. But
well, I think that one of the subjects you touched on was values clarification. People don't know right from wrong. They don't know what's actually a scriptural solution versus just, you know, man-made idea to address a
right.
problem.
Right. I mean, if you know, the prophet tells us to go back to the law and the testimony. You know, we turn back to the standard of right and wrong. Now, the concept of right and wrong should be written in the heart of our listeners, because God has said that he put the law, his law, into the heart of his people Israel. And so a person ought to be able to, just using common sense, figure out, gee whiz, if we're going to have a monetary system, we ought to be using something as money. And yet we've got all kinds of monetary, so-called monetary reformers, who propose that we're going to have a new monetary system to replace the old one. And they can't tell you what they're going to use as money, because they don't plan to use anything as money. They plan to use a unit of measure that measures nothing, which is what we're doing right now. And then they want to nationalize the Federal Reserve, turn it over to Congress, and let Congress do to us what the Federal Reserve and Congress together are doing to us currently. And they have a few little perks that they say that their system is going to provide, like it's going to be, you know, interest-free and debt-free money. Well, it's going to be neither, because the only party that's going to pay no interest is going to be the federal government, and everybody else is going to pay interest on this stuff, because the federal government is going to lend it to everybody else at interest. So it's not even going to be an interest-free system. There has to be interest in their system, because interest is one of the chief regulatory mechanisms to keep funny money from getting worthless almost overnight. You have to have a charge for borrowing nothing. If you didn't have a fee for borrowing nothing, people would borrow lots of it, and it would become almost instantly worthless because there'd be so much of it in circulation, it being units of nothing. It won't be debt-free, because debt is not only a sum of money due, but it's the undelivered portion of an economic exchange. So when one person gives up 100 cents of his labor to get a piece of paper that says $1 on it, and the first party got it for free, the undelivered portion of the exchange is 100 cents that the first party that created that piece of paper got for nothing. It's 100% debt. Just as if you and I were counterfeiting $1 or $100 bills, if we put a $100 bill into the marketplace, that being pure counterfeit, we have just created a debt of $100. We still owe the $100, but we're not going to put it into circulation because we got the $100 bill for free. Okay. All we're doing basically is swapping shingles and swapping one problem for another. And what would be nice to see is if we had some understanding on this subject, so that we could all kind of line up together and address the sin of banking, not the fact that it's privately owned. A lot of people make a big deal out of the Federal Reserve being privately owned. So what? Your house is privately owned. Your car is privately owned, or at least it should be. You know, bank doesn't own it. There's nothing unlawful about private ownership. What's unlawful about banking is that they steal. And they do that by unjust weights and measures, which the Bible commands that we would have just weights and measures. They do that by adding interest or usury on top of the fact that they lend absolutely nothing. They give out false reports declaring that they make loans when in fact they lend absolutely nothing. I mean, they lie, they cheat, and they steal. And that makes banking an egregious sin in the sight of God. And so what do? We want Congress to lie, cheat, and steal. You can't convey to Congress a power that we don't have. Okay? And our founding fathers eventually figured that out. And that's why they withdrew that power of emitting bills of credit. It's theft. And nobody has a right to steal, not even government. So that's what we should have that law written on our heart. We should be able to figure that out. It's pretty clear. It's pretty simple.
Well, also the law of thou shalt not covet, a lot of people don't show any self-control in their desires, and therefore they go into debt to get something that they don't need.
Yeah, and the credit system is the system that feeds avarice. It is the chief facilitator of covetousness, because there is no limit as to how much a bank can lend when a bank doesn't have anything that it's going to lend. Avis and Hertz can only rent you as many cars as they have in the parking lot. When the lot is empty, they can't lend you any more cars until somebody brings one back. But a bank, the banking system in its entirety, when viewed as a whole, has no limit as to how much it can lend, because it lends absolutely nothing. It just simply creates the numbers on its books. That means the public can borrow as much of nothing as the public wants. Now you have no limit as to how far in debt the public can go. At least when there was gold and silver, the public couldn't borrow any more of it than there was. So there was a limit to the debt. Now there's no limit to debt. Yet the Bible says that the rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is a servant to the lender. Well, if the lender lends nothing and the borrower is going to borrow nothing, that means that the borrower can be in debt forever, and he can be a slave or enslaved forever or in perpetuity. And that's the system that's been created. So how do we solve this problem? Well, let's go back to the Bible and find out what the law says we ought to do. If we can't figure it out, we ought to have that law imprinted in our heart, in our genetic makeup. We should know that this is a morally corrupt system. Okay? And then we need to define our terms.
The public school system kind of brainwashes that out of our people.
Absolutely.
Seems like our founding fathers knew to a greater extent than most of the people today.
Yeah, well, of course they didn't go to public school. I mean, the reason a Christian homeschooler can understand free enterprise and can understand constitutional government better than anybody who goes to public school is because he didn't go to public school. Neither did Thomas Jefferson. They learned at home. And that's one of the things we need to do as free people. We need to take responsibility not only for ourselves, but for our children. And the Bible says to train up the child in the way he should go, then when he is old, he'll not depart from it. It doesn't say have the school system train up the child for you. Powers that are delegated, there's a principle in law. Powers delegated are not redelegable. God gave that power, delegated it, to parents. That power is not redelegable to a school system. But that's what parents do, because, you know, somebody wants to play bridge, or they want to play golf, or now we got to have two breadwinners in the household because one can't keep the system or the head or the household above water. It takes two people in the household to bring in enough bucks to keep up with the inflation, the taxes, of this incredible system. And the biggest tax that we pay is not the income tax and the sales tax and the excise tax. It's the tax called inflation. And our forefathers in the 1700s knew that inflation was a tax. The Federal Reserve even pointed that out in a book that they put out from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston back around 1980. It was called, I think, Money in Colonial New England. And they said that the legislators understood that inflation was a tax, and that everybody had paid a tax in proportion to the time he held this imaginary money. And that's only the first, or I should say the second, of three taxes. People are actually taxed three times with a Federal Reserve note. The first time they pay a tax is when they give up something of value, either their labor or production, to get it. So every Fed note in a person's wallet is actually a tax receipt. The second tax that he pays is the depreciation tax. And he pays that in proportion to how long he holds it. That's the inflation tax. And the third tax is when government has the audacity to tell you that you've got to send some of those back to the same government that got those all for free in the first place. It's what I call a triple tax. I mean, these guys are pretty smart how they put this system together. And we're pretty stupid. You know, we haven't figured this thing out by now because there have been plenty of people talking about the Fed. But very few people analyzing what it does. And that is, it steals. And it has a clever way of concealing the theft, and interest is one of the methods that they use to conceal the theft.
The establishment works together on all this. You've got the government, the public school system, the media, and
right.
They're all pushing what's against us. It's not just sending our children to a public school system. We're sending them a system that's run by the enemy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and if you were running this system, how much would you be willing to spend of imaginary money that didn't cost you anything to get to hire somebody to read a teleprompter like Dan Rather to tell the people with a straight face something that isn't true or is only a half-truth? I mean, it doesn't cost them, monetarily speaking, anything to create a system of media, mass mind manipulation. Because all the dollars that they spend on that public indoctrination was free money. It would be worth taking a few billion bucks, and throwing it into the mass communication world to keep everybody under the ether. There is
no money.
They
certainly throw money at the establishment candidates to keep things the same.
Yeah, but again, it's not money. I mean, it's credit, and it's dishonored credit. And it's bad enough that it's credit, because credit, if it was honorable, would have to be paid in money at some specific date or on demand. The fact is, we've got a system that operates on dishonored credit. They never plan to pay down the debt of these credit instruments. They use them to confiscate from the people. And every government on the face of the globe seems to be operating this way. I mean, I can't vouch for all 190 countries, give or take, or however many there are, but all the countries of the world, so far as I know, use nothing but credit. I don't think there's a country out there that is using anything as money. I'd be anxious to hear from somebody if they can tell me that there is such a country. I don't believe there is. No country I've ever been to has ever used anything as money. They just run numbers on pieces of paper. So every country is confiscating from its own people.
You have a book that details a lot of what you've been talking about tonight. Why don't you give our listeners some information about the book and how they can obtain it and how they can contact you for any reason?
The book is entitled Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder. Legal plunder being sort of a spoof, I guess you might say, on legal tender. Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder. It's only 104 pages. I marvel at how people can write 250 pages on why you should walk around barefoot. I could have written a longer book, but 104 pages was sufficient to define terms and to explain the madness in very simple terms, without being simplistic, as to how the banking system works. The book uses copious references to Federal Reserve publications, because it was a time when the Federal Reserve almost couldn't wait to tell you how the system worked. I'm not sure if they're that eager to do that any longer, but they can order the book from me directly. I'm at, Bruce G. McCarthy, or just BGM will work. I'm at 33563 State Route, or Route if you're from another part of the world. I'm from Maine. 537 Graysville, Graysville, Ohio, 45734. And the book will cost you all of $12 for one copy, or two copies for 20, so it's $10 a copy for two. The book is laid out in a very logical sequence, and I would encourage people to actually read the book. I didn't write it in an intimidating style. We define our terms as we go, and it's imperative that people learn the vocabulary of economics or any subject. Whatever subject you want to know, you must know the vocabulary of that subject. And I'm telling you, the people who call themselves economic reformers out there, I could call them by name. I'm not afraid to do that. It just doesn't seem like a polite style. But these people cannot define very simple words. And if you can't define the terms, the words you're using, you do not know the subject. And yet these people are not ashamed to travel internationally and speak to audiences. And the audiences will bring them in because the audiences don't understand the subject any better than the people who are speaking. I mean, there was one leading speaker, I won't mention him by name, who was asked a couple of years ago how he defined the word dollar. And he looks up at the ceiling and he says, quote, "How do we define the word dollar?" And my friend said, "Yes, how do you define that word?" And this person, a leading spokesman, by the way, on this subject, he's got videos out there. Many of your listeners have actually watched his presentations. He says, "How do we define the word dollar?" "Yes, how do you define that word dollar?" He says, "I don't know." And he turned around and walked away. I mean, this is a spokesman.
It reminds me of the preacher. They asked him, "What is sin?" And he said, "Oh, that's a very bad thing." He didn't know it was a transgression of the law.
Right. Which is what and isn't is. That the way with it? When you talk with people about the law of God, and people, you can talk to evangelists, fundamentalists and evangelicals, and they'll tell you that America's problem is sin, and then you say, golly, that's right. By the way, how does the Bible define that word? You know, I've never found a person, other than somebody who's in the Christian Israel message, who can answer that for 1 John 3:4, sin is transgression of the law. They don't know. They don't know the definition of the word Gentile. They can't define the word Israel. They can't define the word Jew. Yet they'll use these words with casual abandon. And they lead whole congregations down a road of insanity. I remember
We've
one
been
woman,
lied
I'm
to
talking,
by all the establishment medicine, establishment politics, and certainly establishment religion. We have a caller from Nebraska on the line. Welcome to the broadcast.
Yes, my name is Jake. Good evening. My question is, when we get the hard money system back, I believe we should avoid usury, but how is that going to work if we don't have usury or interest? That's my question.
Okay, your name is Jay?
Jake.
Yeah. Oh, Jake, okay, yeah. Well, I'd like to, you're kind of positive. You're thinking, you know, when we get our money back, I don't think America's going to go down that road, quite frankly, Jake, because we don't see eye to eye with these issues as our ancestors did. But gold and silver can operate quite easily without usury or interest. And I'm using the word usury and interest as synonymous. It's the credit system that must have interest or usury, because usury or interest are control mechanisms to regulate the quantity, the value of credit. But gold and silver can be put into circulation without it. In fact, Section 14 of the original Coinage Act of April 2nd, 1792, prescribed how that was all going to happen. Because you and I, we, the people, have the power of original issue. Where did the gold and silver come from? We, somebody, would go mine it. Not everybody was going to grow corn or wheat. And if you found that, hey, there's a gold rush going on in California, why don't we go over there and mine some gold? Well, what happens to the gold that we mine? You take it to the United States Treasury, and the Treasury would take that gold, would strike it into coin form, would give you back that coin, and would charge you one-half of 1% of that gold. That was their fee for turning a commodity into a monetary substance, which now has far more utilitarian value because now the public is going to recognize it for what it is. That was the beauty of coined money, that it gained recognizability. And government used to keep that coinage, or was supposed to anyway, accurate to within three places to the right of the decimal. When they struck that coin, and it was 90% pure gold, then however much gold would go into a specific coin, and that was all established by statute, then that was regulated. That's how they regulated the coinage. That coin came back to you. You were the one who would then go out and issue that coin into circulation. You would spend it. And Hollywood would show us that the way we would spend it would be, we'd go down to the local saloon and, do all sorts of illicit things with it. But that's not how it was supposed to happen, but it could happen that way. But we are the ones who have the power to put gold and silver coin into circulation. In fact, George Washington provided this first silver from silver plate, from dinnerware, provided that to the U.S. Mint a few months before the Mint actually opened. And I forget now how much I had that off on the tip of my tongue at one time. But it was a fair amount.
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Suppose somebody had a lot of gold, like an older person that saved up gold, and he wanted to help a younger person that didn't have any capital to start a business. So he would let the the more wealthy person might want to lend this money to the poor person, right? So how would the wealthier person benefit by lending this money to the more poor person if there's no usury?
Well, let's just suppose that back in the old days, the reason people borrowed back in biblical times was because they were poor. It was something that one who was more wealthy would do, what we would say, out of the kindness of his heart. It was a lending that was done, that God prescribed, that if a person was poor by thee, that you would open up your hand and you would provide abundantly. But if that person who was now the debtor repaid what it was that he borrowed, and the person who had made the loan, first off, would have to lend out of his abundance. He couldn't lend out of his necessity because now he would have to turn around and go borrow from somebody else. So there has to be someone who has an excess, which is kind of what the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians in chapter 8 when he tells the people in the church there, you know, let your abundance be a supply for these people over here who have a want that they might not want anymore. And let those people over here who have an excess, let them provide this party over here who is in need, that there might be an equality. But if I paid you back what it was that you loaned me, and I'm paying you back in an uninflatable medium of exchange, you're getting back the same value that you gave me a year, 2 or 3 years earlier. There's no loss to you.
The lender would be taking a risk of losing his of not getting paid back and losing his money, so how would he be compensated for that risk?
Well, the Bible does allow the pledge, you know, where he can take the pledge and keep it if the payment isn't made.
Okay.
Well, if I had something on the top of my head there, and it just kind of just slipped off. If a person were going to make a loan just to help start up a business, he could actually invest capital in the business and become a business partner, couldn't he?
Yes, that's what I was thinking, yeah.
So if he were going to become a business partner, then he would be entitled to share in the profits of the business. Now, if the business
fails... I believe that's
failed,
the way the Arabs do it in some of the Muslim countries, which are trying to follow this law.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that the United States was attacking some of these Muslim countries because the corrupt money system wasn't getting their interest off of those people over there because they didn't have usury in those countries.
Yeah. I guess we can probably see how the political game is really played when a person starts taking a look at banking and realizes that wars are something that are very profitable to banks. Then we start seeing a rationale as to the cause and effect in the realm of international politics and international wars, that they're bank related, you know, just as you're pointing out. But again, a person can take on a partner in a business venture, and then that partner, he was either going to suffer the losses if the business should lose, but he also stands to receive some of the profit if the business should be profitable. I'm not trying to find ways around the usury situation, but there are such relationships as that, and I think that would be, biblically sound.
Okay. Goodbye.
Okay, no, thanks for calling, Jake.
Yeah, thank you, Jake. And if anybody else would like to call, the number is 877-924-7722. That's toll-free. Or they can call direct at 678-949-5091. We'd ask that you please call quickly because we only have a few minutes left in the program. But anyway, we thank you, Jake. I'd like to announce that we have a comic book that makes the subject of money simple. It's called The Temple of Imaginary Money. It's a cartoon book, and it explains first the Bible quotes, and then our guest tonight, Bruce McCarthy, writes the introduction, couple-page introduction, and then the rest is in cartoons, and it explains to the general public in a simple way about imaginary money, as the title indicates. We ask $3 for that. I see we have another caller from, looks like, New Mexico. Welcome, you're on
the air. Yes. I am calling to request that he announce his telephone number a couple of times more clearly so that I can order the book. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I can give the telephone number. Yeah, my telephone number is 740-934-2808. I'll give it again, 740-934-2808. Of course,
I don't take credit cards, so they would still have to write you in order to.
Yeah, in fact, I should make mention that we don't take checks. I don't have a bank account. I don't deal with banks. So if a person wants to order the book, it's $12. He can send $12 in Fed notes. That goes through the mail quite well. Or you could send silver, whatever the current exchange rate is on silver. I don't keep up with it, but just send silver. There are some people who do that. I'll be glad to take your phone call, though, if a person wants to call and ask any questions or discuss the subject at length.
You want to repeat your mailing address?
Okay, 33563. State, Route 537, Graysville, the color gray, Graysville, Ohio, 45734. The commu number again is 45734. And the book is called Lawful Money versus Legal Plunder. Just say you want the book. That's the only book I have currently in print. I think you will find the book is packed with information. It's very small, but I don't spend an awful lot of time repeating myself. Most books don't have an awful lot of material in them, usually about one or two ideas. I think you will find that this book is a whopper with regards to how much information is in only 104 pages. In fact, there's a banker up in the Toledo area who said that he learned more in the first 15 pages of this book than in all the college courses that he took to become a banker. And he's a bank manager. I mean, he's not the owner of the bank. But I've had good results talking with bankers and such people, even Federal Reserve bankers. Once they know you understand the system, they become rather transparent, and they'll start admitting to what kind of fraud this whole system is. It is a house of cards. And a lot of those people who work in those banks are worried about what's coming down. Yes.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but we have a caller from Texas.
Okay.
Welcome to the broadcast. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Hello there, Bruce. How are you? This is Lark.
Hi, Lark. How are you?
I'm fine. I just want to encourage you to talk up this thing that you term the pipeline, because I think that there's no better time than now to talk it up.
Oh, well, that was something that we actually were going to talk about, but we never got to it tonight. And we've only got about 2 minutes, I think, before we're going to get. But yes, the pipeline was a trade network that we established back in 1984. It's not running currently because we didn't get enough people to. We didn't get the critical mass necessary. But what the pipeline was intended to do and did do was connect principals together. People who had something that they wanted to sell, somebody else wanted to buy it. It was very simple. And all the transactions were done in substantive money, gold and silver. No credit instruments, no Federal Reserve notes whatsoever. Or you could trade if you wanted to trade wheat for blueberries or cheese for, whatever. But it was a way to step outside of the banking system and actually restore lawful money to circulation. It's what the BRIC countries are starting to do or trying to do, only they're going to do it with their own credit instruments. And we didn't do that. We just used hard money. And I was able to go for 10 years without using Federal Reserve notes, which there aren't too many people probably in the country who can say that. So that's about all I can probably say in the amount of time that we have remaining. I wish we had more.
Well, I appreciate your comments, but I, for one, champion, you're speaking out about this, more and more. You have a powerful voice, and, I'm convinced it's the only way to go right now. I've personally been out of the system since 2005, so it can be done.
Well, good. Good. Thanks for calling, Mark. I haven't talked to you in quite a while.
All right. Well, good to hear your voice and appreciate the program.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for the call. Bye. And, of course, people can start on the local level. They don't need a national organization to trade in lawful money or in substance. I know that Putin is supposedly making Russia more self-sufficient instead of depending on the outside world, and I think that's what we need as a nation and also as individuals, is to become more self-sufficient.
Right.
Well, I'd like to thank you for being on the broadcast again tonight, Bruce. You covered a lot of ground, and we appreciate it. But we're at the end of the hour, so we've got to close for now.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We pray that your spiritual ears have received today's message, and that you are fed with strong meat relevant to solving the needs of our nation and Christian civilization everywhere. Herald of Truth is sponsored by Kingdom Identity Ministries through the financial support and prayers of listeners like you who love the truth of God's Word and want to see it broadcast throughout the land to awaken His people. If you would like a
CD
of today's message, tell us the date and station to which you are listening and send a donation to cover our cost plus help with radio time to Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602. We would appreciate donations made by our international listeners to be in U.S. funds. For a free introductory packet of information, including our doctrinal statement of beliefs, plus lists of books and tapes to aid you in your study of biblical truth, write Kingdom Identity Ministries, Post Office Box 1021, Harrison, Arkansas, 72602, USA. Or request this material by calling 870-741-1119. That's 870-741-1119. Visit our internet website by going to www.kingidentity.com. Type www.kingidentity.com. We invite you to listen regularly to Herald of Truth broadcast for more dynamic messages proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom at this same time and station.